These lectures are part of the Superstar Teachers series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. The lectures on these tapes are titled History of the English Language, Part 3, English in America and Beyond. The lecturer is Dr. Seth Lehrer. Dr. Lehrer is professor of English and Comparative Literature at Stanford University, where he currently serves as chairman of the Department of Comparative Literature. He received bachelor's degrees from Wesleyan University and Oxford University. He received his doctorate from the University of Chicago. Professor Lehrer taught at Princeton University from 1981 to 1990. He has taught at Stanford since 1990. He has published 6 books, including Chaucer and His Readers, and Courtly Letters in the Age of Henry VIII, and is the author of over 40 scholarly articles and reviews. Professor Lehrer has received many awards for his scholarship and teaching, including fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Guggenheim Foundation, the Beatrice White Prize of the English Association of Great Britain, and the Hoagland Prize for undergraduate teaching at Stanford. Lecture 25, The Beginnings of American English.
Hello, and welcome to America. This is the first lecture of the third part of the history of the English language. In this lecture, I'm going to look at the origins of American English. First, by looking at some settlement patterns and some geographical locations for the origins of American dialects, a feature of American English that I'll be exploring in greater detail in later lectures. But in addition to these points of origins, dialectic and regional variations, I'm going to be looking at some of the key grammatical and morphological distinctions between American and British English. I'm going to talk a little bit about pronunciation. And I'm going to conclude by looking at 2 major writers of the early American period that define the language of the history of the language in America, but that also look back to Johnson and the 17th century grammarians in describing linguistic practice and social behavior. Now let's begin. Where does America begin? America begins with a series of settlements down the eastern seaboard. In New England, the foundation of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and Boston in the early 17th century. New London, at the mouth of the Connecticut River in Connecticut. The Middle Atlantic, New York, founded as New Amsterdam and seized by the English from the Dutch in 1644. Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, founded by William Penn in 1681. The South Atlantic, Virginia, the Jamestown colony, Charleston, South Carolina in the late 17th century, Georgia in the 1730s. Each of these settlement areas are points of dialect origin in the early American colonies. Dialects in America tend to follow points of initial settlement and also tend to follow lines of natural rather than man-made geographical boundaries, in particular rivers and mountains. The settlements at the mouths of rivers, interestingly enough, become settlement points for linguistic change as various regional dialects, especially in the New England area and in the Mid-Atlantic area, as it were, can be mapped by looking at the flow of rivers and the spread of land between them. Geographical movement and settlement brought the English language in its American forms west. The Louisiana Purchase of 1803 and the rise of encounters of Americans and English speakers with both Native Americans and with French-speaking settlers and colonists in New Orleans created the possibility not just of new words coming into the language, but of new languages being formed. And in later lectures, I'll talk about the developments of what have come to be known as Creoles in certain regional parts of the United States. The California Gold Rush at the end of the 1840s and the beginning of the 1850s brought pioneers mainly from the Northeast across the United States or by sea to California, And this, in some sense, explains some of the regional affinities between the California set of accents and the Northeastern accent. What is the sound pattern and what are the forms of early American English? Now, one could go into great detail about the varieties of American English, about the differences between American and British pronunciation. I only want to sketch out some of the most obvious ones and some of the ones with the earliest or most fundamental history. Let's begin with phonology, with the sounds. In American English, a major feature of pronunciation is what's called the ash sound, ah sound. This is a term that modern articulatory phoneticians use, and they've borrowed it from the Old English ash. The ash sound is just that, a kind of ah, and we might call it intuitively or colloquially a short a in a word like cat or hat, the broadening of the mouth, cat and hat. But this A remains ah in father. Now, in British English, this would have been cat and hat. And so this shorter A does not become the A sound in American English, but stays cat and hat. In a word like father in modern spoken British English, it has been argued that a lower and further back A, aw, was developed in the 18th century in response to the stage pronunciation of the actor Garrick. Garrick was such an influential figure in late 18th century England that his stage pronunciations affected the pronunciation of the everyday language. And this sort of characteristic, or one might even say easily parodyable, aw in father, that we might think of as if we were doing dialect humor a la Chaucer, father. This is a descendant not of an etymological or historical sound, but of a stage sound and an affectation. Ah and ah. R is extremely variable. The sound of R is very often a marker of American regionalism, as it is a marker of distinction between British and American English. We tend to pronounce the R in words like father and lord. But speakers of British English tend to retract or even not pronounce that R. And so father becomes father, and lord becomes lord, milord. This variable R and the presence of R is a distinguishing feature of American speech noticed as early as the early 19th century by recorders of the language. The short O similarly distinguishes British from American speech very early in the differentiation of the two forms of the language. Americans would say not and hop and hot. These are unrounded sounds. Rounded versions of these would be with greater rounding of the lips. Not, hop, hot. It is a hot day in England, but it is a hot day in America. Another basic distinction noticed as early as Webster in the early 19th century is syllabification. Americans tend to pronounce all the syllables in a word, and British speakers tend to level out or syncretize the number of syllables. A word like secretary in American is secretary in British English. A word like necessary is necessary. A word like literature is literature. Laboratory, laboratory. Aluminum, aluminium. These are changes in word stress which also distinguish British from American English. Certain vowels, certain consonants, and certain patterns of syllabification and stress are some of the key distinctions in the sound or the phonology of American English. In grammar, as we've seen in earlier lectures, several American dialects preserve older forms of the language, in particular strong verbs like slud and clumb or clomb for climb, instead of climb, climbed, climb, clung, or even hope, as the old strong verb of help. Now we say help helped, but in Old and Middle English, help, hope, hopin', there are still some American regional dialects that preserve this older strong form of hope. One of the key features of modern Standard English is the elimination of the grammatical category of the distinct plural and singular second person. We say you, and we really don't know whether we are referring to you in the singular or you in the plural. It has been argued that in certain varieties of American English, the tendency is to restore or recreate a plural second person. Hence, in the South, y'all. Y'all is not ungrammatical or illiterate. It may rather be seen as an attempt grammatically to distinguish between you and y'all. You, singular, and y'all, plural. Or, in certain other class-based or region-based dialects, phrases like use or use guys. Use guys is perhaps another way of trying to get back to a grammatical distinction between the singular and the plural. Moreover, there are certain words that American English uses that British English uses differently. And here, I'm not referring to the kinds of different terms for technical things like hood and bonnet in a car, for example, that are modern differences between British and American English. What interests me is how American English occasionally preserves older semantic resonances. For example, in American English, the phrase, I reckon, or I guess, meaning I sort of understand in some sense. These are obvious Americanisms, but they're remnants of a much older form of English lost by British speakers. The development of the English language in Britain did not end in the 18th century. Uses, forms, grammar, syntax, style, and pronunciation were still changing, as they were in America. A characteristic Americanism of I reckon, which we might think of as the language of the saloon rather than the salon, is in fact the language of an earlier time in the history of English. Indeed, a phrase, I guess, meaning something to the effect, not I'm guessing the answer to a question, but I believe or I imagine or that's what I think. This is, interestingly, something that American English shares grammatically, not with British English, but with the Scandinavian languages, which also preserve this older notion of the verb guess. Now, in the 19th century, British travelers came to America and they noticed some fundamental distinctions between the American language as they heard it and the English language as they learned it. Actually, these attitudes predate these first incursions. Alexander Gill, who you will remember is the author of the Logonomia Anglica, and a figure noted not just for the detail, but the extremity of his views, lamented in the 1621 revision of his book, Logonomia Anglica, the introduction of words such as maize and canoe. These are words borrowed into English from incursions into North America. Maize borrowed through contact with Spanish and Portuguese travelers, and canoe, a word clearly, at least to Gill's mind, borrowed directly from the Native American languages. Visitors to the colonies very often noticed new terms from Native American languages or other loan words. And these vocabulary terms, as Gill had done so, were often ridiculed as barbarisms. In addition, many speakers of British English found American pronunciation and American grammar curiously barbaric. Some good examples can be taken from a Mrs. Trollope, who traveled to the United States in the 1830s and recorded her attitudes towards language as follows. She said in 1832, I seldom heard a sentence elegantly turned and correctly pronounced from the lips of an American. There was always something either in the expression or accent which offended. Now, here the sense is that someone is responding to sound. This goes back to issues in Johnson and issues in earlier writers about associating grammatical propriety with social propriety. In 1839, a traveler to the United States responded as follows. It's remarkable how very debased the language has become in such a short period in America. And the examples that this writer in 1839 says, he offers the phrases right away, as in I'll get to it right away, or admire, as in I'll admire something, I admire that, or the verb to fix, meaning to prepare, as in I'll fix dinner. Clearly, this British speaker of 1839 didn't see anything broken with the dinner that needed fixing. Now, of course, we can see these as evidence of attitudes towards language, but of course, in the kind of larger anthropological sense, we must ask, how valid are the native informants? This same writer, in 1839, reported such bizarre expressions as this one, an American speaker who says, "Sir, if I should have done so, I should not only have doubled and trebled, but I should have fourbled and fibled my money." Now, this is a very funny example, and H.L. Mencken, about whom I'll talk in a later lecture, a great historian of the American language, H.L. Mencken records this example, and I'm taking this example from Mencken's book, The American Language. And Mencken says, he takes this story, actually, with a very large grain of salt. He says, "Unfortunately, it's hard to believe that an American who was so plainly alive to the difference between shall and will, should and would have been unaware of quadrupled and quintupled. No doubt," Mencken says, "there was humor in the country then as now, and visiting Englishmen were sometimes taken for rides." Well, what kind of ride would the visiting Englishman been taken on, and what kind of ride did the American feel compelled to take not only the visiting Englishman, but the at-home American? Attitudes towards American English are not just phrased by visitors, but by so-called native or homegrown or adopted Americans. Let's take a figure like John Witherspoon, who was born in the early 1720s in Scotland, who came to America in 1769. He was a figure of great power and prowess in the United States. He was a key figure in American politics and education. He was, for a while, the president of Princeton University. And he argued that Americans made improprieties in grammar. Let me give you an example. Writing in 1781 in a series of what we would now call journalistic or newspaper articles, Witherspoon says the following. "I have heard in this country, in the Senate, at the bar, and from the pulpit, and see daily in dissertations from the press, errors in grammar, improprieties, and vulgarisms, which hardly any person of the same class in point of rank and literature would have fallen into in Great Britain." This is an amazing statement, it seems to me, by Witherspoon. And it has to resonate now to us with all of the 17th and 18th century idioms of language and language use. Improprieties and vulgarisms. You'll remember now the vulgar is not just the common or the commonplace, but the low. Impropriety here in 1781 in America is now not just a grammatical error, but a social error to be associated with the vulgar. What are the hierarchies of speech here? The Senate, the bar, the pulpit. These are the institutions of American public rhetorical life. Errors in grammar, improprieties, and vulgarisms. Americans, he said, do not speak as grammatically as their class counterparts in England would. But Witherspoon goes on, the vulgar in America, and now I'm quoting from that same disquisition, the vulgar in America speak much better than the vulgar in Great Britain. For a very obvious reason, he says, and this is his reason, that being much more unsettled and moving frequently from place to place, they are not so liable to local peculiarities, either in accent or phraseology. There is a greater difference in dialect between one county and another in Britain than there is between one state and another in America. And this is the first sustained observation of another key distinction between British and American English. British English regional dialects, as I have mentioned at earlier points in this course of lectures, are on occasion almost mutually incomprehensible. This is true historically, as forms of Old English and Middle English would have been written or transcribed with such differences in spelling as to indicate a near incomprehensibility of hearing or reading by other speakers. And it's true today, even casually one could argue, that to travel the 400 miles from England, from London, let us say, in the south, to Scotland in the north, to pass through regions of Midlands, is to pass through regional dialect variations that are a veritable panoply of change. But what is remarkable about America, Witherspoon noticed, Mencken would notice in the 20th century, and others notice throughout this period, is that in spite of clearly definable regional variations, for the most part, the American language is more uniform geographically than the English language is in England. And so when he says the vulgar in America speak better than the vulgar in Britain, what he means is that the common people in America speak better than their social counterparts in Britain. And so let's take these two quotations in opposition. On the one hand, Witherspoon is lamenting the fact that the educated classes, the members of the professions, and the arbiters of political and social rhetoric do not seem to speak as grammatically as their counterparts in class and profession do in England. However, the common people, the everyday speech that you would hear on the American street, is different from the commonplace speech on the English or British street because, for the most part, it is better. We move more frequently. And he says there's greater difference in dialect between one county in England than between states in America. This, in effect, leads Witherspoon to conceive of an American language, and in particular, to conceive of a term which he calls an Americanism. Witherspoon coins the word Americanism. He coins it on the basis of the word Scottishism, which linguists in the 18th century used to refer to particular locutions, words, phrases, or pronunciations that were unique to the Scottish or Northern form of English. What is an Americanism? Witherspoon defines it as follows. I understand a use of phrases or terms or a construction of sentences, even among people of rank and education, different from the use of the same terms or phrases or the construction of similar sentences in Great Britain. It does not follow from a man's using these that he is ignorant or his discourse upon the whole inelegant. Nay, it does not follow in every case that the terms or phrases used are worse in themselves, but merely that they are of American and not English growth. The word Americanism, which I have coined for the purpose, is exactly similar in its formation and significance to the word Scottishism. Look now at this phrasing, and in particular, look at this phrase, English growth. What he means here, I think, is the use of the word growth in the way, how can I put this, in the way a vintner would use the word growth to describe a classification of wine, or the way in which a landscape creator, a landscape architect, or a landscape artist would use the word growth to describe the way in which a plant was shaped, or made, or formed, or perhaps bred in some sense. American and not English growth. Language, once again, is an organic thing. It is alive. It is a hedge. It is a vine. It is a flower. It is a fruit. And the American language is as much distinctive and unique here as an American fruit or vegetable or kind of hedge would be. Witherspoon is one of the defining figures for late 18th century American linguistic history. He records usages. He writes eloquently about distinctions in use, and he provides later writers in America with the sustained sense of terminology from 18th century English grammarians and lexicographers. But perhaps the most important, and indeed perhaps the most notable, of American writers on language is Noah Webster. Born in 1758, died in 1834, born in Hartford, Connecticut, received his B.A. from Yale. In the 1780s, he published in several editions what he called a grammatical institute of the English language. This country, he said in the Grammatical Institute, must in some future time be as distinguished by the superiority of her literary improvements as she is already by the liberality of her civil and ecclesiastical constitutions. Notice that this is a work, first came out 1783, second edition 1784, third edition 1785. Notice the word constitutions. A constitution is the way you're made up. Your constitution is your physical well-being or your health. To constitute something is, in academic parlance, to make it up, in some sense to see how things are made up or constituted out of elements or parts. What function does the word constitution have in the 1780s? Perhaps half a decade before the Constitution. The idea here, it seems to me, of Webster's political prescience, the notion that this country must in some future time be as distinguished in literary improvement as in civil and ecclesiastical constitution, is to say now that the grammatical institute of the English language is a study of the institutions of politics and power. The notion of grammatical education here in Webster, much as in Priestley, in England, is really an issue of language as social and political instruction. In 1791, he published what he called Dissertations on the English Language. 1791, a few years after the formation of the United States. Webster says, as an independent nation, our honor requires us to have a system of our own in language as well as government. 1791, an independent nation. Go back to Joseph Priestley, writing in the 1770s. Priestley said, I think it not only unsuitable to the genius of a free nation, but in itself ill-calculated to reform and fix a language. These are the terms I want you to hear. The prescience of writers on grammar to political and social change. That is, when we look at the history of the language, we're also looking at historical politics. And Webster, like Priestley, recognizes how important it is, in effect, to do politics by doing grammar. In 1791, he said, Webster said, a national language is a band of national union. So the issue of Americanism for Webster is not simply the issue of a turn of phrase, of a pretty growth, of a change in, as it were, the crew of language, as it was for Witherspoon. Americanism is the American language, is the way in which linguistic identity is coterminous with national identity. Independence is not just independence politically, but independence linguistically. In my next lectures, I'm going to look at Webster, Mencken, Lincoln, Douglas, Melville, figures who give voice to the American self. And in my immediately following lecture, I'm going to look at Webster's American Dictionary. Published in 1828, it had as much impact on the American language as Johnson's dictionary had on British English. Webster seeks to create in the American dictionary the form and function of an American language by recording particularities of spelling, by recording particularities of pronunciation, but also by recording the distinctive idioms of America. Webster says, and I will conclude here, language is the expression of ideas, and if the people of our country cannot preserve an identity of ideas, they cannot retain an identity of language. Ideas and language, social life and politics, the American Dictionary inaugurates not just a new era in the history of dictionary making, but a new era in the history of the language. And it will be the purpose of this third part of lectures in this series to limn the contours and to show the arc and sweep of an American language as it grants the personal identity of Americans and the social identity of the nation as a whole. Thank you.